Good evening. James McCanny here with My Science Hour, March 12, 2015. Many topics to cover tonight, the first of which, I'm announcing my new course. Finally, I've been talking about this. I've had notes on my homepage prepping people that to read my books, listen to the CDs and DVDs to prep for this. This is the first of the full university-level courses. And for me, this is a very important point because I have tremendous amounts of free material on the web page, on the radio show. I'm on interviews on radio shows all the time, and all of that is free. But here is what has happened. I have such an incredible amount of material that I have to present for posterity. And a lot of this work I have in the background. It's never really been released to the public. And so on this level, on a university level, it's something that is like my books, etc. It's a concentrated effort to put this amount of detailed material together. And the amount of material, you're going to be pretty much amazed when you start looking at this. The first course has now been posted on my webpage for sale. And so just to give you a preview, this is disc number four, DVD disc number four. There are already three discs. One and two are the historically important videos that go way back into the early 1980s, showing me as a young man progressing through my career as I've given lectures in front of audiences, etc. And so anyway, that is DVD number one and two. DVD number three is the introductory kind of a cosmological overview to what was then going to happen with DVD number four is the current release. This contains, and I'm going to go through, this is the introductory course, and so what I'm going to do is start out with the broad picture and then work in on smaller details. So here is the topic list, and you can see this on my webpage also. This is the topic list for course, I would call it course number four. Galaxies, symmetry, fluid dynamics. This is fluid dynamics on a galactic level. Stellar orbits, fusion engines and galactic structure, special and general relativity, reality versus myth, redshifts, quasars, the IEDRS, that's my induced electric dipole redshift, which is laboratory, been proven in the laboratory, and shows how quasars and galaxies and stars, any fusion-based object, or comets, in fact, produce a redshift, and this is how they do it. So that's going to be a part of this course. And remember, much of this is already introduced in my books. I will not be repeating what's in my books. That's why the books, CDs, DVDs that I already have are required reading. So I'll go on with this list. Cosmological structure. Mass loss, conversion to light, the age of the universe, the age of our sun. Gravitational versus electrical effects. Interstellar, galactic electric currents, Hans Alvin, then and now. The speed of gravity, initial formation of galaxies, stars, and planetary systems. Capture as the primary mechanism of solar system formation. The introduction of Planet X types of objects. And you'll see that very early in the cosmological scenarios, the topic of Planet X comes out completely full-blown. You'll find out why there are many Planet X types of objects. The violent universe, a wolf in sheep's clothing. Life, creation versus evolution, science by direct observation. There's a talk at the end called A Walk in the Forest, kind of a parody on A Walk in the Universe, and then The Diamond Principle, which, of course, is one of my books. Then there's an addendum which deals with comparison to standard science, in which I show that the topics like the Okay, just to give you a quick list of the comparison to standard science, these are standard science topics, and I'll be covering these, and by the time you get done, you are going to understand yourself, not with rows and columns of PhDs standing there trying to convince you, but you're going to understand yourself why standard science is upside down and backwards, so incorrect, and etc. But anyway, here's the standard science topics that I'll also be covering. The Big Bang, cosmic background radiation, the Hubble constant, Hubble distance, and the age of the universe, special versus general relativity, black holes, dark matter, and the missing mass, theories that make no sense, so they invent undetectable missing mass, circular reasoning, galaxies, and so-called density waves, missing mass to explain light curves in galaxies, the scientific religion, where did these theories come from, the axioms of astronomy and fairy tale science, evolution versus creation, cosmic plan versus chaos and randomness, the misuse of Stephen Hawking's name, electrically neutral universe, and the measurement of neutral space problem. That I've talked about, how standard science does not understand spacecraft design nor detector design. They don't understand what it means to measure an electrical potential. Then also the comments on Tier 1, 2, 3, and 4 science, approved science for the public, interpretation of telescope and space probe data, the published rubber stamp peer review journals, illegal textbooks, and the textbook industry. So that's some topics that I will also be covering. And like I say, by the time you get done with this, not only will you understand that standard science has complete vacuous theories, just as an example, since 1933 was the first time that dark matter was introduced into the astrophysical community, astrophysics, astronomy. They have been looking for dark matter since 1933, and nobody has ever detected any. They can't tell you the properties. They really can't tell you much about it at all, only that they need it to patch up theories themselves that don't work. So anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that, but I'm very happy about this course. The reason I'm comparing to standard science is primarily for posterity, because someday these people are going to be trying to cover up and backpedal about as hard as you can backpedal to try and pretend like they never heard of this stuff. That's why it's important to bring this up and put it into black and white now, and so that someday when they try and backpedal and change their story, it'll be well encoded. Okay, so at any rate, once again, this is disc number 4. Let me just talk a little bit about price structure. This first course is $89.95. There will be about 7 hours of lectures. There's problems, there's photo sessions, there's 25 problems at the end of the course, and these are very, very difficult problems. They make you think. They're going to make you understand what cosmology is all about, and that's kind of the overriding theme of this particular disc, DVD number 4. This is completely downloadable. In other words, there's no disc to send out. There's no DVD mailing, none of that. It'll be completely downloadable. And that's why we have to ask people to be patient, because you're going to get a time slot. God, you are going to get a time slot in which probably about a day's time in which you get to download the program or the DVD. This is a very big download, and so we can't have everybody downloading all at the same time. So you will get 3 emails when you make your order. 2 of them will be simply a Visa and an order confirmation receipt. The third email will be an email that gives you your time and some data that will be recorded in the download. Everybody will have a customer stamped download, so that your particular download is particular to you. This is for copyright protection. At any rate, I'm very happy with this. The future courses will be $50 per session. And I hope that they are that you will find that these will be very good quality and something that people will still be watching in 100 years. So anyway, visit the webpage jmccsci.com, and it is now posted and available. So I'll possibly make a few more points on this towards the end of the show, but there's a lot of material to cover tonight. The weather, first of all, the weather has done a complete flip. Up until just days ago, we were having severe, severe winter. All of a sudden, it's 70 degrees out, and many parts of the country are heading in for super flooding. Okay, so anyway, turning from cold to hot, but flooding. Tremendous flooding. We're going to expect this spring with all of the snow melt, etc., and something it's on my 11 world mega projects is to salvage this water. How absurd that every year the snow melt runs down a river off into the Gulf of Mexico or off into the Atlantic or wherever, and then we end up with a dry southwestern desert. That all of this water could be salvaged, moved, and to green the southwestern desert. What an amazing plan. California is, of course, still very dry. The underground water supply is used up. And one thing I noticed comical this year is they did not use the term polar vortex. That was kind of last year, the polar vortex year. And so they even refer to it as that, as the polar vortex year. what kind of, it's more than funny. Let's just put it that way. This is amazing. A solar-powered airplane going around the world nonstop. Well, it's making some stops. And they have to wait for weather because this is a rather delicate, lightweight machine. But they then will fly across the Pacific, across the United States, I understand, a number of hops. That'll be very interesting. I'm sure it'll bring out big crowds. And then the flight across the Atlantic and ultimately back to, I believe it's Dubai, where they took off, and that'll be the last stretch. But flying around the world on solar power. So very interesting, and my hat's off to those people. I'll just give you a clue on something. It's a project that I started back in the early 1980s. This was to have completely electrical space vehicles. And so there's some hints of this in my work. If you know my work well enough, you can find out where some of the notes on that are. But some of the other notes are not public domain, so I have not made that public. But going into space and coming back, completely electrical. And now that is where things should be, because the simple reason is because you don't have what you call inertial systems. A rocket is an inertial system. You heat up something, a chemical, you blow it out the back end of a rocket nozzle, and that causes propulsion. But there's a problem. It's called the rocket problem. And the more payload you want to send up, the more fuel you have to add, but then you have to have more fuel just to lift the fuel. There's a point of no return. Chemical rockets or nuclear rockets or any kind of inertial rocket has a point of no return. There's just a certain point you can make them so big, and that's about it. The Russians have probably the biggest rockets that ever have been made or ever will be made, and with the greatest lift power. So big kerosene rockets, they're still using the same rockets that they built in the 1960s. There's a humorous space story about the Russians. NASA back in the 60s, when they were in the Apollo program, solicited a company to design a pen that would write in outer space because there's no gravity, and a pen, like a ballpoint pen, depends on gravity to pull the ink down in the tube down to the ball tip, or in the same with any type of pen. Gravity is involved, so if you don't have a gravity environment, how do you make a pen work? So at any rate, they paid a lot of money to a company, or soliciting companies, to design a pen that would work in outer space. And after, you know, a large contracts, etc., they came up with one. The Russians used a pencil. It works every time. Another announcement this past week, Sunday, Day International Women's Day. Now, what does that mean to me or to you? You know, I don't know if they have a men's day, but we have one to honor women. The whole idea is that women are very special, and without them, none of us would be here, literally. So, and then all of the other things that they do. Hats off to Women's Day last Sunday, the International Women's Day. Now, this past week, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, NASA came out with a broad spectrum news announcement. This means they had blanket coverage. There were over 100 news agencies and probably many more that you can't count or weren't visible, regurgitating this news announcement stating that NASA had discovered that Mars, the planet Mars, had oceans, that there were vast oceans on Mars, and that they had discovered this. Well, up to this point, NASA had been tippy-toeing around this topic, sending little rovers up to the Martian surface, digging little teeny holes, trying to send a lander down in a crater near the pole of Mars, various things that they were trying to do to see if they could find traces of water and figure out what happened to the water. All this time, in over decades, since the first Martian pictures of the Martian surface came out, I said, hey, Mars had oceans, and it was recent. And I'll go into the reasons here why it had to have been recent. So what happened to the oceans on Mars? Well, a guy named Emmanuel Velikovsky will tell you in his books that were printed in the 1950s. He said the ancients, and remember what he was doing was not trying to confront astronomical theory or anything else, he was simply saying that the ancients, he was studying ancient texts and talking about what the ancients told us regarding ancient history. Regarding Mars, he had discovered that all the various nations of the world from the ancient world said the same things, that Mars was a blue planet, that a large comet came by and basically ripped off its ocean and atmosphere, leaving it the red hulk that we see today. So Mars, according to Velikovsky, was a blue planet and lost its oceans recently. It was a blue planet, just like Earth. So this would imply that the people understood that when you saw that blue planet up there, that it was a water planet. So, and then there's indications that there was actually spacecraft flight between Earth and Mars, that Mars was on an orbit which brought it much closer to Earth in its annual passage through the solar system, and that there was actually space travel between Mars and Earth. So very interesting. All of a sudden, and NASA wouldn't touch this topic with a 10-foot pole. My Picture of the Day subpage, posted very many pictures of Mars showing the areas where the Martian surface was, and my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, which goes back to, when was that published, 2004, something like that. It was the third major book in my series of books, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, was the first one. Then there was the surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, a 60-page smaller book. Then there was the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. And that also talks about ancient history, the ancient catastrophes, etc. And then there was the weather book. That was the third of the major books, and that was a major achievement because it was originally a 600-page book that I had to reduce to 300 pages to make it saleable to the public. But in that book, the center of the book has 8 full-page, high-resolution prints of the surface, the entire surface of Mars. And in there, I detail how the, and I show you where the oceans were. NASA, the boys at NASA, couldn't stand it anymore. They basically stole my idea and work and put it out there and pretended they discovered it. Now, let me name who this is. Michael Muma, a joker who I've had nose and run-ins with quite a few times at NASA. He's the clown, and his student, a guy named Kerry Liss, basically, when the X-rays in comets were discovered in 1996 by accident, they absolutely had no idea why comets would have X-rays. I pointed out that this was one of my theoretical predictions. It's in my work. You can read it in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. My 1980 and 81 publications are in there predicting X-rays and comets 30,000 or far out to the sunward side, and that was due to the electron beam. They basically, you know, absconded with the idea and then came up with something. I know Tom Craven, I know all these jokers. I've been at American Geophysical Union standing right next to them. They're a bunch of very nose-in-the-air, arrogant people. Tom Craven isn't so arrogant, but he hangs out with the wrong crowd. But basically, they came up with this charge exchange idea that somehow protons in the solar wind cause a charge exchange with the atmosphere of the comet, causing X-rays. Well, isn't that swell? The only problem is there's two main problems. And, of course, nobody can get a word in edgewise or talk to the journals that publish these NASA articles because they're just rubber stamped. But number one, first of all, the charge exchange process needs an electron beam to kick it off. Where does that special electron beam come from? Well, there isn't any in the Dirty Snowball Comet model. So right off the top, it really doesn't work. But since nobody can ask any questions or get a word in edgewise when NASA and like journals like Science are involved, then how can you pose a question? Second of all, why doesn't it work in front of Earth or in front of Venus or in front of any other planetary object? Why just comets? What's so special about comets? Well, they can't answer that either. The reality is that it is the electron beam, the discharge of the solar capacitor on the sunward side of the comet, and that is the cause of X-rays. So now let's go back to Michael Muma. Michael Muma was the guy he's kind of been in charge of that group at Goddard for all of these years. Back in the earlier days, I was at a meeting, the American Geophysical Union meeting, and actually you can see the poster that I had. It's one of my 3 posters that I sell on my webpage. It could be 1997, something like that. At any rate, I had a poster there, I was standing there, and all of a sudden Michael Muma comes up to me. In the background are probably 20 graduate students, all standing there with their eyes open about as wide as they can be, and they're standing about 30 feet away. Michael Muma walks out of the pack and approaches me, and they're all standing there watching. And he comes up and he tells me under his breath, he says, "We don't really like what you're doing here." I'm pretty sure that's about 98% accurate exactly what he said to me. And I said, "Oh, yeah? You got a problem with that?" Because I had the plasma discharge comet model and other information about electrical conditions in the solar system. And he goes, "Yeah, you really shouldn't be doing this." And I'm like, "What are you talking about, dude?" And so anyway, I said, "Oh, does that mean I'm supposed to only reference published articles and make little adjustments and publish articles that are just small adjustments on existing publications? And he goes, yes, telling me that I'm not allowed to bring my theoretical work into an American Geophysical Union meeting. Well, I can't tell you on the air what I told him, but you can probably imagine. So anyway, that's Michael Muma. Now here he is, the year 2015, stealing my idea on oceans on Mars. Now he's got a new boy called Geronimo Villanueva, and he hands the baton off to these people. So he comes in, has the great discovery, then hands the baton off to one of these clowns, like a newbie that doesn't have any clue what's going on or the history of any of this. And now all of a sudden, there they are prancing around talking about oceans on Mars. And of course, NASA Power the Press, they have the ability to completely blanket cover all of the news media. But what they're saying, now let me talk about the science of this. What they're saying is that what they are claiming is that they took a series of photographs from ground-based infrared telescopes and discovered that there was a imbalance of deuterium deuterated water, it's called, in other words, heavy water. It has a deuterium atom in place of the one of the hydrogen atoms in water. So regular water is H2O. Deuterated water is DHO. So there's a deuterium atom, which is a hydrogen atom with a neutron. And there's one of those, then there's an hydrogen atom, and then an oxygen atom. But now what they've done is they use, in typical NASA fashion, they use circular reasoning. They start with the assumption that the planet Mars is 4.5 billion years old, which there's no proof of that at all. Second of all, they assume that the water was there 4.5 billion years ago. They don't tell you how the water got there. They don't have any explanation for how water got there in any proportion of deuterated water or regular water. They don't have any explanation of how water got there. But then they say they can calculate the rate at which hydrogenated water left. Okay, the reality is that a ratio of deuterated water to regular water, let's just jump off to another topic. A number of weeks ago, I announced on this show a finding from the Rosetta Space Mission, which is at the comet 67P, and they measured a deuterium to water ratio that was much higher than normal, than on Earth, and thus proving that the water from comets allegedly could not account for the water on Earth, because Earth has a much lower ratio. So at any rate, let me point something out here. Now, first of all, the Rosetta mission, the comet, is farther away from the Sun, as well as Mars, as well as asteroids, etc. And I'm just going to make a quick insertion here. The NASA spacecraft Dawn just arrived at the minor planet Ceres, which is in the asteroid belt, and not a word on any scientific discoveries on that minor planet. So I'm not going to say any more. It's just very typical NASA fashion. They announced that they got there, but no information, no science news at all. And I suspect that they're covering up the data, trying to patch it up, because obviously Ceres is a planet that is exhibiting water properties. So anyway, that's important, because if it has water properties, which it shows from a distance, then how could it possibly have water after 4.5 billion years, because it would have all evaporated away long, long, long time ago. And so anyway, obviously contradictions there abound with the standard theoretical picture that standard science, fairy tale science, tries to present to the public. Okay, but back again to Mars. Now, they're saying that this ratio of deuterium water to deuterated water to regular water proves that the water left very slowly over a long period of time. And what I'm telling you is that there could be seven other explanations to Sunday. and all of them resulting in a high deuterium to regular water ratio. So this by no means proves anything at all. This was just some excuse for them to jump in and steal the work that I have been presenting all along. Nothing more, nothing less. But let's look at the reality of the surface of Mars. And you can look in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. You can look on my homepage, the Picture of the Day subpage, where I have large amounts of quite a few pictures of Mars showing not only the surface of Mars, the recent water erosion activity, but also dust storms, tremendous, tremendous dust storms that are continually on Mars in its faint atmosphere. And if this had gone on, these dust storms, for 4.5 billion years, the surface of Mars would not be recognizable, even after a short period of time. So actually, you can put an upper limit on the time frame that the oceans have been off of Mars. And there's two ways to do this. One is with the dust storms. And one of the pictures of the dust storms that I show is coming right off one of the ocean beach areas where there used to be an ocean and then there were islands and then the beach area. That's on my Picture of the Day subpage. Also cratering from meteor impacts. Now, the one thing I point out in my book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, is that the meteoric impacts are zero. When you look at the lowlands, what they call the Martian lowlands, there is very little cratering, just almost none. Well, of course, there isn't, if there were meteorite impacts, then they wouldn't last because the ocean, first of all, they wouldn't create impact craters. And if they did, they would be smoothed out and washed away almost instantly from the ocean. And so Mars also has a much higher impact rate than Earth as far as meteors and meteorites and asteroids are concerned because it's right at the edge of the asteroid belt. The asteroids are thick and heavy out in that region. Also, there's kind of a misnomer here. Let's talk about what they call the asteroid belt. Many people have this image that it's something like Saturn's rings, flat, very well organized, with a bunch of asteroids moving around in perfectly circular orbits around the Sun between the gap between Mars and Jupiter. This is not the case at all. I remember a wonderful program that I had back in the early days of computers and animation. It was called Dance of the Planets. It actually ran on a DOS machine, if you even know what that means. The old DOS, IBM first generation desktop computers. But this program was called Dance of the Planets, and it had an asteroid orbit capability. And so when you clicked on that, all of a sudden it started showing the orbits of the asteroids. And these are going in every which direction. It looks more like a big donut, and it crosses the orbit of Mars. It doesn't come that close to Jupiter because Jupiter is a tremendous gravitational force and just sweeps it out and gets rid of them. But the region around Mars is very heavily populated with asteroids. So Mars really gets labeled constantly with asteroid collisions from outer space. And you see this on the surface of Mars. The highlands of Mars are heavily cratered. And it's right up to the shoreline. And then all of a sudden, you look at that lowland region, and there's no cratering at all. Now, there was a time when the fairy tale science from NASA said that all the cratering in the solar system happened 4.5 billion years ago, and none of that happened since. That's the old Carl Sagan days. He had hardly gotten that out of his mouth during the old Cosmos series days, and NASA realized, whoops, cratering goes on all the time. Now NASA has a near-Earth asteroid program headed by none other than Carl Sagan's students, Dr. David Morrison, which talks about thousands and thousands of impacts, many of them happening per year, about one major impact per day on Earth. On Mars, it's even higher. So the question comes back to how long could Mars last with fully one half of the planet not getting any crater impacts at all? And the answer is, well, not very long at all. You do find a few craters out there, but they're few and far between, very sparse, and so you could put an upper limit of a couple thousand years maximum that those oceans have been gone. Look at the riverbeds. Now, this is something, too, that I've noticed once back in the early days of the early Mars missions. I started collecting pictures that were released by NASA. And, of course, when I was at Cornell back in the 79 to 81 era, there was a lot of data available, and I captured that. What they've been doing is photoshopping out this is the public release images, they've been photoshopping out the riverbeds, the other water erosion markings on the planet Mars. Isn't that special? Photoshopping going on at NASA. And so anyway, these guys now, Muma and the boys, are free to show pictures. In fact, one of the most clearly photoshopped areas of the planet Mars is called Olympus Mons. It's a tremendous volcano, much bigger than any mountain system on Earth. It's so tall that it sticks out above the Martian atmosphere, but it was heavily, heavily eroded with rivers, river flows, just like you would see on, say, the Hawaiian volcanoes, or which are some of the biggest, most well-developed shield volcanoes, and a lot of river erosion activity, a tremendous amount of erosion activity on those mountains. That's what Olympus Mons was like. You could see the sloughing off the coastlines where big fissures of lava would break off, and slough down into the existing ocean, miles and miles out to sea, just like happens with the Hawaiian Islands, the same type of sloughing action. And so, at any rate, this was all visible in the early photos of Mars. Now the photos that you see of Olympus Mons are totally photoshopped. You don't see any of that. But the pictures that are available shows tremendous recent water erosion. A lot of the pictures that have come from the Mars rovers shows little teeny water erosion areas. Now, a couple of years ago, I went to an American Geophysical Union meeting, and one meeting that I especially wanted to visit was the recent pictures that came from one of the recent Mars, both satellite photos and ground-based photos of the planet Mars, was a group of geologists. These were geologists that worked with NASA, but they were also independent. Nobody attended their meeting except me. I went in there, and I got to sit down nose to nose with these guys and chat. They were very embarrassed because they were not allowed to say that this was recent. So here you have geologists who are familiar with water erosion on Earth, on the planet Earth, and they are looking at the surface of Mars close up and personal. And they're saying out loud they are not allowed to talk about this being recent. They have to say that it's 4.5 billion years old. Now, this is just bizarre. These are trained geologists understanding full well what they were looking at and not being able to say it, and nobody went to their meeting except me. They pointed out just amazingly over little rock falls where water had flowed, showing how this was an ongoing, like a river, like a fall, a small waterfall where the erosion had taken place. They had pictures of this, but as I said, yet they could not say that this was recent. They were not allowed to. Okay, so back to this idea of how long could Mars go on like this and without oceans, without water, without rain, without clouds, without an atmosphere, how long could it go and preserve the geological features that we see on Mars today? And the answer is maximum, maybe 4,000 years, absolute outer maximum. And that's the time frame that Velikovsky puts on this. Yet in typical NASA fashion, they have to go back and say this was 4.5 billion years ago. Complete fairy tale science. But they had to step in because I was becoming so successful at promoting the idea of oceans on Mars and the fact that they were recent, but they had no other choice than to bring in the big gun, Michael Muma, thief and liar, and put him on. I just want to add that Velikovsky, during his lifetime, I believe he died in like 1976 or 7, something like that, did not have good pictures of the surface of Mars, unfortunately, or he would have been able to speak about this himself. There were many of his discoveries, including electrical noise on Jupiter, etc., magnetic field of the planets, that he predicted based simply on what the ancients said. Many of his predictions, and of course, he was lambasted. Let me tell you the biggest problem Velikovsky had. He had two problems. Number one, he was surrounded by a bunch of jumping up and down yahoos that are still around today, a clown named Dave Talbot, who's destroyed the name of Velikovsky, trying to gain notoriety for himself, and jumping up and down, acting like crazy people relative to NASA. Velikovsky was a very reserved, very respectable scholar. And the second mistake Velikovsky made, first of all, he should have just told all those people, look, I work alone. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Thank you, but I don't need your support. Let's put it that way. Second of all, he tried to theorize based on astronomical theories of the day. And so he tried to use the what was known at the time the ice ball comet model, and to try and justify his historical findings coming from the historical recordings of ancient civilizations. Velikovsky tried to justify this in terms of science, where he should have said, hey, I'm not a scientist. We'll have to wait for the future to discover what's going on here. And so those were two major mistakes that Velikovsky made, and he made some serious errors astronomically in trying to justify his historical findings, which really were based on the adjustment of calendars. That's what Velikovsky was really studying. When I came along at Cornell in 1979, I did not know I stepped into a beehive. At that time, I didn't even know who Velikovsky was. I was telling a friend about my theoretical work, about publishing in peer-reviewed journals, and the grief I was getting from the Cornell Astronomy Department primarily. And he said, well, have you ever heard of this guy, Velikovsky? And I said, Velikovsky? You know, he mispronounced it. And so anyway, this was about 1981 at the end of my tenure at Cornell. I shouldn't say tenure, that's a term. That my faculty period of being a faculty member there, and so I looked up and I said, "Gee, this guy's talking about exactly about what I've been studying and promoting, and that's why I've been getting such a tough time from the astronomy department. I didn't realize the toe to toe tangled that he got in with Sagan, and of course, where's Sagan? He's the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell. So little did I know I had stepped into one of the biggest beehives on the planet, and here I am using NASA data to publish the electrical nature of the solar system. That's where I coined the term electric universe, and I'm publishing in peer-reviewed journals my work, and clearly getting met with some serious resistance. Okay, so at any rate, enough of that, but I got some other topics I have to move on to. But the NASA announcement of oceans on Mars, clearly, they're getting worried. I'm becoming far too successful with my work and with my influence on the public. They are trying desperately to step in and steal and twist and anything By the way, about 3 months ago this started, I talked about this last week, a smear campaign on my name and work. I'm not going to talk any more about that because there's some serious topics to cover tonight. And by the way, if you hear some noise in the background, I'm not at my usual studio, so there's a bit of background noise of which I don't have any control. Just a note on next week, I'm going to be twisting to a new topic. This coming in from a listener talking about health and the electrical nature of the solar system, planet Earth, etc. And it's something I've done a lot of studying on before. And there's many, many aspects to this. Back in the mid-90s, I was working with a group of Earth scientists, atmospheric scientists from the University of Novosibirsk in central Russia, Alexei Dmitriev. And they were studying my work. They would translate it into Russian. They had a translator, and they would meet, like, daily, working through my work, and then they would email back and forth. Some of those emails are contained in the appendix of my weather book. But at any rate, they had in attendance there a couple of the professors from the psychology department. And their particular interest was on electrical influences on the psyche of people. They were in particular interested in studying astrology. They were convinced that astrology had a basis in science, and they were very interested in my work because it showed how the planets electrically aligned and enhanced the electrical currents, magnetic fields, etc., in the solar system. And so then they took my work, and actually they were making studies on unborn babies because they figured that the influences, the electrical influences and magnetic and other types of influences of the planets and the moon, the lunar cycles, etc., would be most characteristically recognized by unborn fetuses. And so they had sensors, and they were detecting the influences, and then they came to realize that at the point of birth, the baby would be born, and all of a sudden the other senses would kick in and many times take over. Some people remained with their active connection to the planets, and that's where astrology comes in, that people are actually tuned, and so this actually happens. I remember my good friend Brad Walton, who now deceased, talk show host from WCCO, and I was on his radio show many, many times. Very interesting, there were times when I was on, we would pre-record a show, he would be playing that on WCCO, and one of the big powerhouse Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota stations, and on the other station I was a guest for a full show on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on KSTP. So I had two stations where I was a guest at the same time, which pretty much blanket covered all of the United States because those were, of course, Coast to Coast had its entourage of probably 450 to 500 radio stations, and WCCO cranked up its towers. They had 50,000 watt tower, and it would go clear channel, meaning they could broadcast at full power at that late hour of the night. And it would cover through to, actually, England would pick it up. Any place east of the Rockies would pick that up. So very interesting. But at any rate, I was on with Brad Walton, and we were talking about this very topic of health and the electrical nature of the solar system, etc. And okay, but at any rate, that's just a little preview. I'll be talking about health and the many, many different types of conditions, electromagnetic conditions in the solar system that directly affect you on a daily basis. And once again, this is from a listener request, and I realize that that's a topic that I've been away from for too long. And so that's starting next week. I don't know if it'll be more than 1 week show, but there's many aspects to that. And partly I think people have forgotten how to live a tranquil lifestyle, to be just to be relaxed, etc. But we have many external influences, and of course in this modern world there's many more influences that are unnatural. So more on that next week. This story just in, it was confirmed, I was told that Marlin Arms, that there's a company that's sold primarily, as I understand it, hunting and sports rifles and arms, closing, being bought up by a company owned by George Soros. And so anyway, I have a posting on my webpage regarding that. And so go to my webpage. It's under the right column on the homepage under current events or other news topics. Something that everybody should understand, because in the last year, apparently about a half a dozen major arms manufacturing companies have closed their doors and have been purchased by the same company. So this is something that everybody should go and take a look at. There's a offshore wind farm that just was commissioned past all of the political hurdles, etc., has had the funding, etc., to put five large three-blade wind towers off the Rhode Island coast, off of Cape Cod. Now, what's the problem here? The benefit supposedly is going to a place called Block Island, but I bet you the Canadians would have something to tell those people. These installations are typically subsidized by the government, as in with Canada, each tower in I believe it was the Thunder Bay area, received $500,000 per year from the government, whether they produced any electricity or not. They sell these systems based on full capacity, and it's just another ruse. That's all I can tell you. And they will find out the hard way. Right now they're using, I believe it's fuel oil to burn to generate electricity on Block Island. They're claiming that it'll be a 40% reduction in electric bills for this island. But what's going to happen is the expense of maintaining a power plant that runs very infrequently is almost the same as the cost to run it full time. And so you have all of the same expenses, and who's going to predict when the wind's going to blow and when it's not going to blow. So at any rate, I think this is something you will see in the future. Plus, I guarantee you in the contracts, they don't have any provision to take down, dismantle those towers if they don't work. And this is very standard. The Canadians found this out the hard way. They're still paying for three-blade wind generators up there that don't work. They're paying for these while still paying for outrageously increasingly high electric bills. And so the first offshore wind system in the United States, they like to reference Denmark and other European countries. Those countries have outlawed three-blade wind generators. You can read more about this in my McCanny Wing Generator ebook, and part of the book is dedicated to the myth of alternative energy, and that's one of the topics. How the companies like, and get this, General Electric, guess who's one of the big money makers on the offshore Block Island project? GE, who has a big stake in nuclear power. Isn't that special? And there's a reason these companies get in on the so-called alternative energy industry, because they can make the money, they can soak up all of the money that would go to alternative energy, and then if real projects come along, then there's no money left and the people have a bad taste in their mouth to prevent real progress in alternative energy from ever happening. So, at any rate, a very unfortunate series of events there. For many years, that project was blocked by anybody. Even the Kennedys were out there. They said that that would be an eyesore on the horizon. And so, but that's not the main issue. my wing generator, you put one of those out there, it would produce more energy than all five of those put together. You would have real energy, including at low wind speeds, consistent energy, and it, at a much lower price. And these, of course, are fixed wind towers. They're already putting the bases down, from what I understand. At any rate, that I'll keep reporting on, and I'm sure that that's going to end up as a giant disaster, possibly in the courts someday. But once you find out that the contracts were never clearly written, and the companies that make all the money are going to be long gone with the profits, and possibly even still be receiving subsidies. Just another quick note. There's a battle going on which is not hitting the U.S. press, except in the background. Obama is politically threatening to attack a country called Venezuela, just like it did with Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And so something I announced, I did a little bit of coverage on that last week. It's not being covered that much in the U.S. mainstream media, but there's an election going on there. The CIA was unable to distort that election. They've been in there, as they usually do, trying to muck up international politics in foreign countries, but they have been unsuccessful. So they're now taking the next step, because oil is the key issue there, Venezuela, of course, being aligned with the Iran, Russia, China, India, the BRICS nations, Brazil, Bolivia, Cuba. And so the bankers who use Obama and the United States as a spearhead, the European bankers, are losing ground fast, and they're getting very nervous. So they got, you know, they picked the wrong guy for Obama. They should have kept him on the sandlot basketball court. They just got the wrong guy. He's no match for international political figures who know the game, and they're very tuned to what's going on. So at any rate, we'll keep following that. But I believe the election is coming up in the next month in Venezuela, so expect a lot more rhetoric in that department. And actually, behind the scenes communication is that the United States wants to physically attack Venezuela, causing it a threat. Very bizarre. It can't get any more ridiculous than that. Okay, just the last few notes on the release of my Astronomy, Astrophysics, Space Science course. It is now on my homepage, jmccsci.com. Go there and make sure you have to read the books, etc., listen to the CDs, watch the DVDs prior to the course. But you can get the full download of ebooks and get going on the course right away. It's an amazing moment, very advanced level material for those who really want to cover this. And by the way, it is for the general public, so don't be afraid of it. It's very, very clearly written and discussed in the lectures. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.